Welcome to the Building Science Podcast.
Bringing the human factor to architecture and design.
Brought to you by Positive Energy in Austin, Texas.
Okay, hello and welcome back. Welcome back, everybody, to the Building Science Podcast. Really glad you're here. I'm Christoph Irwin. I'm also glad that Corey Squire is here today. Hello, Corey.
Hey, Christoph. Super excited to be here.
Yeah. So this is the long-promised part three to the podcast series on your book. Part one was about the roll power of architecture. Pen controls the backhoe, if I remember right, one of the quotes. You have any quick comments about part one?
Yeah, part one, the book's divided. It's a, first of all, book, People, Planet, Design, A Practical Guide to Realizing Architecture's Potential, is the title of the book. And it's divided into three parts. The first part is on theory. Why are we doing what we're doing? What is architecture's role? What are buildings' role? And what is our potential to do good in the world? Part two, beautiful, which we recorded on maybe a year ago now, all about culture. So we didn't get into technical architectural design strategies, but it was how to talk about sustainable design, how to talk about health, how to talk about carbon, interpersonal relations, how to set goals appropriately, how to retrieve, collect information.
Right. Why is it some firms are able to do this and others ain't?
Right, exactly. And it all comes down to firm culture. And part three of the book, which we'll explore today.
Yes.
Is we'll get into design.
And building systems.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to jump into that. I also realized, thank you for the bookkeeping there, Corey. Definitely need to talk about the title of the book. We should introduce you. For those of you that haven't listened to parts one and two, I would actually recommend that you do that. It would probably be beneficial for the coherence, but this probably could stand alone as well. Could you introduce yourself and your role?
So my name is Corey Squire. I'm an architect. I'm a sustainability director at Bora Architecture and Interiors in Portland, Oregon. And I'm also a member of the AIA's Strategic Council. And I'm an advocate for sustainable design and the author of the book People, Planet, Design, which we're going to be talking about today.
Fantastic. And firm Department of Sustainability?
Yes, and Department of Sustainability is my consulting firm.
Okay, let's see. We have 10 sections to try to get through. So we'll have to be somewhat judicious. So we're talking about building systems, and they would group into big systems would be enclosure systems and MEP systems, I guess. Or actually, there's so many. There's climate systems. But as far as building systems, you started with scale.
I wanted to talk about design elements of a building that lead to high performance outcomes. And I wanted to think about how to organize these. And they're organized differently in different contexts. So if you look at something like the Framework for Design Excellence, it organizes design strategies or best practices by outcome. So it's water, equitable communities, ecology, energy, change. If you look at something like a LEED rating system, it's also similarly based on outcomes. You have energy, you have sites, you have water.
Right.
But I wanted to think about this more from the perspective of the architect who's designing the building, so focusing on building systems. So we don't cover every building system. We have 10 building systems, and I take a little liberty about what I consider to be a building system. And nominally, they're ordered in your ability to have a positive impact. So the most impactful systems come first. And that's why the first one is scale. And not just the size of a building, but specifically the proportions and the massing and what opportunities getting the scale right early on kind of affords the design moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that three powerful words that are maybe not said quite enough are smaller, better buildings.
Smaller, better, yes.
In that order, of course, smaller, better buildings. And I think also it's important, we're talking about scale here, the order that we're going to go through, scale, windows, air quality, roof, da-da-da. Today, listeners, let's not quibble, right? In different contexts, in different projects, right? You could argue that these could go in a different order. And, I noticed that there's no mechanical systems, but air quality is going to be associated with mechanical.
And mechanical systems is touched upon, again, because it's the perspective of the architect. So it's not, there's no MEP section, but it's definitely touched on in air quality mm-hmm. and quantity, and it's definitely touched on in electricity. So we kind of split it up in those two ways.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything specific about scale?
So big moves are mentioned in this section. Things like getting the orientation right, right? Making sure the floor plate is narrow enough so that you have daylighting that penetrates the entire occupiable area. And as Christoph mentioned before, right sizing, smaller, better buildings, right? What can we benefit just by building less, designing smaller, flexible spaces?
Right. So the floor plate one is interesting. It, you know, pricks up my attention because there's a relationship between a scale that has floor plate that allows for daylight penetration, you're already nodding, and increased exterior surface area, right? So how do you weigh those two?
Well, I think that, obviously designing a very small surface area to volume ratio, which results in deep floor plates where people are 50 feet from the exterior of the building,
right?
That is not the right approach. So you do increase your surface area when you have narrow buildings, but you're also decreasing the amount of effort it takes to get services to the center of the building.
Hmm.
So it might seem like you're spending more money on the enclosure and you might have more opportunities for heat to travel in and out. There is a lot of effort, a lot of energy, and a lot of equipment that is required to bring light and materials, to bring light to the interior of a deep space, to bring air to the interior of a deep space. Well, when you are near the exterior of a building, you have opportunity for air. You open the window, right? You have opportunity for light. The light, sunlight comes directly in. People are happier there. And that's traditionally how buildings were designed before we had electric lights and mechanical systems to deliver air.
Yeah, we had H's and E's and...
Right, all the letters.
We have O's,
donuts.
Yeah, eights. Yeah.
So, yeah, all sorts of good stuff.
Could I actually interject?
Yeah.
So, like, maybe it was just, you know, when you say you prefer narrower floor plates, you know, I went to 20 feet in my head. Right? Yeah, this long, like, snake of a building that's 20 feet wide. So what do you think is a... What's a deep floor plate? What's a narrow floor plate? Is there numbers to this?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the rule of thumb that I offer in the book is that daylight can penetrate about 2.5 times the height of the window header into a space. So let's just say that the window goes up 12 feet. That means that you can get light about 28 feet into a building, right? And then if you could do that in two sides,
60 feet.
You're at 60 feet. And if you need a 10-foot corridor or whatever, you have cores or bathrooms in the middle, you can get up to 70 feet. 70 feet is not a 20-foot building like snaking through, right?
70 is not what I would call a narrow floor plate.
But 70 is narrow enough, or maybe we'll say 60 to 70 is narrow enough to get daylight to where the occupants are, to get services in the middle, to have kind of people near windows.
Right.
So you don't need to go to the 20 feet, but it's not the 300-foot deep office tower slab that takes up a full block.
Costco.
Right.
The 2.5 times the height, was that already thinking about things like light shelves and high windows and reflecting off the ceiling?
It's high windows because it's the height. It's two and a half times the height of the window. You want the windows as high as possible.
Oh, so you're not talking ceiling heights.
Right, we're not doing ceiling height, we're doing the height of the window. Mm-hmm. So if... Best case scenario, the height of your window is aligned with your ceiling height because that's as high as you can get it.
Right. But there are ways to reflect the light deeper into the building, and I wondered if you were accounting for those.
No, this is a rule of thumb, right? And there's some conditions you might be able to get the light a little bit further if you do have light shelves or super
lenses,
reflective surfaces or mirrors.
Yeah.
And also, you might not be able to get the light that deep if, let's say, that you're shaded by adjacent buildings.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good rule of thumb to get you started.
Okay. Yeah. And then there's orientation impacts.
Yeah.
Okay. So scale, that was width, height. Is there scale and height?
Yeah. I talk a little bit about height, I guess later chapters related to things like how far are people from the ground plane where the activity is? Can people see trees out of their windows, which gets increasingly difficult as you get too high.
Yeah.
A certain level of height is really important for density, but...
Yeah.
You could probably get to a point where it's too much.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, shameless plug for a previous podcast with your wife, Elena, introduced me to Bill Bram, and one of his PhD students did a study actually thinking about the cost of moving people and services up higher on buildings and looking for this optimal, which actually depends on sort of the region and the power grid. But generally speaking, it was 7 to 8 stories tall. It was like sort of an interesting height. And if you're optimizing really for sort of mass flows and energy flows of people.
And I think that, I mean, human scale, from a human scale perspective, you probably end up there as well, maybe a little bit shorter. But you think about a city like Paris, which is a dense, livable city, and there's no 30-story buildings in Paris, right? It's basically 5 stories, 6 stories, the entire city.
Yeah,
so it optimizes multiple... And that's actually something I talk about in the book a lot, is kind of there's a lot of convergence where different systems optimize, where energy systems, human systems. And when you think about that for the lens of scale, there are building orientation scales, massings that just work better inherently than others.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's like almost a, I don't know, human psychological seduction by saying, let's not do the normal thing. Let's go away from these rules of thumb and make a building that is, you know, much taller and skinnier and narrower. And
But maybe that's not what we should be doing.
Right, yeah.
Maybe we figured all this stuff out.
All right, so you have a building. You've scaled it nicely. It's appropriate height, width, depth. And now you want to get that light in. You also want to get views. Windows are pivotal to the design of a building. Yeah, there's lots to unpack here. You're nodding. Go ahead. Start unpacking.
Yeah, windows are just fundamental. And we think about high performance. We think about health. We think about equity. Everything really circles around the windows, right? If you design a building and get the windows right, it is really well set up to basically achieve every outcome that we want to achieve. If you get the windows wrong, it's almost impossible to recover. And getting the windows wrong could mean too many windows. It could mean the windows on the wrong orientation. It could mean windows that don't open. There's lots of ways of getting the windows wrong. Getting the windows right means an appropriate window wall ratio, appropriate geometry that allows for daylight and views, generally facing the right direction, generally operable, generally some control device, whether that's an exterior shade, shutters, louvers, something that allows an occupant to kind of adjust how light and views are coming in, filter a little bit.
I love how you just implicitly made it exterior. That's great. I mean, interior shades work with lighting, but as far as energy, it's already in.
It's already in, right. Yeah. You have a little benefit. It's a little hotter by the window, and maybe it conducts out. But yeah, you really need to stop the heat from coming in.
And you have success on your buildings, on your designs? Let's just say with Bora.
Yeah. I listed a few important features, and I would say the most important is the window wall ratio or the glazing area. Often a mistake that architects make is just providing too much glazing. And if you have more glazing than necessary, first of all, it doesn't make your daylight any better. It probably makes your daylight worse. You're replacing solid insulated wall for a very conductive material, glass. And mullions, and you're allowing a lot of heat gain, and then losing all that heat in the winter. So what you often see kind of, so I call this like an unforced error. When we're designing for sustainable outcomes, high performance outcomes, we don't want to make unforced errors, right? But there's this prevailing culture around glass where it's like people say it's, I don't know, provides transparency or
communion with nature.
Right. Right. As if like sitting in a controlled space in a glass box is any sort of communion with nature.
Yeah, my communion with nature would be fresh air in there.
Right. And then often the way that people attempt to rectify this unforced error is like just extensive shading, right? It's like, oh, we have too much glass, so now we're going to have to shade it. And then it's very expensive because glass is already more expensive than solid wall. And then we're going to kind of realize that we have too much light or too much heat or too much heat loss, and then we're going to put a very expensive shading device. And then that shading device gets VE'd or something like that, and then the mechanical systems upgrade. So we really need to think about buildings kind of from a thermal transfer standpoint, right? We want to maintain the heat or the cool in the building, and also from a prospect refuge standpoint. People don't like to be exposed in glass buildings, right? They like little protection. They want to be able to look out without necessarily being seen. So people don't even like spending time in those all glass buildings.
Yeah, that's well said. Yeah, actually, I was going to make a similar point that, you know, the mammal in us, you know, it, even in an office building, I suppose, there's some sense of being sheltered, right? So we want to feel shelter. And if, you know, so we are coated with thermal sensors on our skin. And if we are in an environment where the surface temperatures are constantly and dynamically changing based on, you know, where the sun is and the wind and the cold outside and the hot outside, like deep down in us, we don't read that as good shelter, right?
Yeah, so you're going to be constantly adjusting.
Constantly,
right?
Wondering why there's like this sense of unease or something. And that's subtle and hard to really to quantify, but it is definitely impactful. The other one was maybe also subtle and hard to quantify, but architecture, the broader culture, it has and it still currently embraces lots of glazing.
I think we're slowly moving away from it because people realize just how ridiculous it is. Yeah. That's my hope.
I love that you could just say that. It was such direct. it's ridiculous.
Yeah. You see, so one thing that you need to do when you design a building for less glazing is you need to provide a really thoughtful approach to the opaque wall, right? And that's a design opportunity, right? A default, unthoughtful design approach is let's just put curtain wall, right? And then the buildings don't look that great. Maybe it looks great for a photograph. Maybe you have an evening shot where it's glowing or whatever.
In infrared, right? Infrared.
and people love that in magazines or...
Yeah.
But focusing on solid wall. So the number they give in the book is 30% window wall ratio. I think I say 30 to 40%. Like, get your window wall ratio in the range of 40%. 30 to 40%. And that means you have 70 to 60% solid wall. And that's a design opportunity. And that could be an interesting brick pattern. That could be terracotta. That could be corrugated metal panel. There's all these opportunities to do something really, really nice and a really interesting design. And I think that architects almost have to relearn how to design opaque walls.
Yeah.
And you're seeing more, I would say that there's more examples of really beautifully designed, well-articulated solid walls. Let's say winning design awards in the last 2 or 3 years, and you're seeing less of these all glass curtain walls. So I think that's a very positive, positive development.
Yeah, and I love that. Relearn how to design opaque walls. And I would hope that those awards are very influential. Right?
I think so. I think they are.
Yeah.
But that's my hope as well, like, right?
There's those two powerful words, developer-driven. Do they care about the awards? I guess so.
I worked on this project once where the developer kept on pushing for more and more glazing for a spec office building. And we ended up doing renderings that included like messes of jumbles of cables that were now visible because the windows fell below the level of desk. So to get the point across that this is not a beautiful design approach. Actually just, it looks messy.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I'll try not to stick with windows too much longer, but I have one more point, right? But just at the most outer level, almost like the scale of windows is what we're talking about, right? Here, and you know, curtain wall. Right, so buildings do this other thing, which is really important. They do relational signaling, right? They signal your values. I'm trying to intuit what a glass curtain wall building signals, and I think, like, and I'm not trying to be like dark about it. I think what it would signal is we humans are so clever. We can do what we want, and we can make it work out, right?
I have the money to pay for the heating bill.
I have the money. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's another... relational signal of power in society. Yeah.
We can throw in solar heat gain coefficient quickly. I think I give some recommendations in the book around U value solar heat gain coefficients. I think if you look at, let's just say, code minimum or ASHRAE standards, they typically say lower solar heat gain coefficient in the south, higher in the north, higher U value in the south, lower U value in the north. It's all well and good, but what I think is increasingly important because of our changing climate is that a lot of our buildings are going to end up in the south because the south is coming north. And that means that areas in the United States and other, maybe the upper, more temperate United States, other temperate areas of the world really need to focus on solar heat gain coefficient, really need to work on keeping heat out as if they were built in a lower latitude.
And
that's just seems really, really important to me. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's well said, and it's borne out by the fact that most new homes in Canada now have air conditioning, cooling, air cooling, right? And so, yeah. Okay. Well, good. So speaking of conditioning the air for human occupancy, the next is indoor air quality. And you said this is where you fit in mechanical systems.
Yeah. Definitely mechanical systems work here. So I guess counting down, we started with scale. Windows are probably the most important aspect of a building for human enjoyment. You get views for energy because of solar heat gain or heat
super
loss.
Impactful. Mm-hmm.
But if you're thinking about health, which is, again, a really important fundamental purpose of buildings, it comes down to the air quality. So this chapter is actually called Air Quantity and Quality, because both are important.
Beautiful.
And if we want to focus on people, we really need to be thinking about our air. We need to be cognizant of how much we're supplying, when we're supplying it, and what quality of that air is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. And why does air quality matter?
Yeah, I mean, air quality is just fundamental from a human health standpoint, from a cognition standpoint. You look at correlations between high CO2 levels in classrooms because the ventilation isn't adequate, and test scores decrease, right? Mm-hmm. And memory and creativity decreases. We learned during the COVID-19 pandemic this correlation between air flows and air quality and filtration and transmission. Looking back on the pandemic, we now understand it to be basically a pandemic of the indoors. Spaces that didn't have adequate airflow and didn't have operable windows were just unsafe, unoccupiable, while places with adequate ventilation could basically function as normal.
Yeah. Yeah, we live in air of our own making, is how I like to describe it. And we can make it however we like. And generally, we like to make it ignored. It's invisible.
Right. We can't see it, right? We can't see it, so we don't think about it. And one of the positives that might have come out of the pandemic is people are much more cognizant of the air quality in the spaces around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not to go back too much, but windows, I was actually realizing that there are also studies that talk about performance, you know, work performance, school performance, health recovery in hospitals for having windows, having views of
for
nature.
Views, yeah. Views of windows, connection to the outdoors. People feel, going back to windows. Windows are just so important. We're going to go back to windows a lot.
We'll probably do it every time. Roof, windows.
If you can't, if you're able to open a window, even if you choose not to, the studies have shown that you will have a greater satisfaction of your space and feel more thermally comfortable.
Yeah.
There's just, we don't like being trapped inside of spaces.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah, I agree. And see, again, you get back to the mammal in us. It's like we forget about that. We're just like, we're these humans and there's this animal that has definite instincts about this. This is a box I can't get out. This is a cage versus an opening. Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't really kidding when I said connection to nature being ventilation air, being you open that window, you are now connected to...
You're physically connected,
I mean,
to nature.
In some ways, you could say, oh, it's terrible. I could have wildfire smoke come in. But if you don't have wildfire smoke, you're having healthy microbes coming in and plants and even the pollens, you know.
And in this chapter, so I talk about definitions of indoor air quality. So what are the various particulates, how to think about VOCs, how to think about particulate matter, how to think about CO2 levels, what are appropriate ranges. I propose appropriate ranges for each of these so that we have a benchmark to compare to. And then specifically, how do you address each of them, right? You don't address VOCs in the same way you address particulates. So it's really important that you understand each of the potential impurities in your air and you have a dedicated design strategy to include it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that about the book. It's, you know, theory and practice that we were talking about the first two episodes. They're always backed up by these crunchy, by these actionable information. Now, here, interestingly, I said this on the last podcast too. I regarded crunchy as meaning like quantitative and definite. And someone emailed me about the podcast and said that to that person, crunchy meant like
hippie.
Granola and hippie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God.
Connotations.
I've been saying that for years and I totally misread it. But so also this is where.
You're talking about crunching the numbers.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I guess that's exactly where it comes from. It's like this is a quantitative thing. That's what I mean, crunchy. As opposed to squishy, right?
Right.
Like is it.
Qualitative.
Is it better or, you know, not better? Like, I don't know. Let's figure out something we can measure. Like VOCs, like PM 2.5 or PM 0.1. But. This is also, in my opinion, and if I remember right, it's been a minute now since I read the book. This is where you talk about the enclosure, right? If you want to control the quality of the air, you need to contain the air.
Yeah. Talk about And this chapter discusses infiltration. It discusses ventilation, discusses a controlled way of bringing in air, the level of filtration that's necessary to deliver fresh air.
Air changes per hour, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. We often don't think of the enclosure as being important for air quality.
Right.
And that the word infiltration, it almost has like a sinister to it. And it kind of should, right? Unless it's infiltrating directly through an open window or door, it's going through some area that almost certainly wasn't intended to have air flowing from outside to in or inside out.
Right, and I always receive a question like, don't we want our buildings to breathe? Like, right? That comes up all the time.
I'm going to pound my head on the desk.
It's like, yeah, same thing. It's like, no, we don't want wildfire smoke and car exhaust emissions coming through our walls into our buildings.
Yeah.
Right? That is the opposite of what we want, right? We want to be very controlled and deliberate about the quantity and the quality of air that we're intentionally bringing into our buildings. And we want to have operable windows that can seal down if there's wildfire, but open up on the majority of the year when the weather is nice, when the air quality is good, because we're always going to get better air quality that way.
Yeah, okay, so that's scale, windows, and air quality. That's three of the seven. I think we're going to maybe pick up the pace and or depth. But the next one is the roof. So seemingly simple building system. Let's talk about the
seemingly simple building system. And I think that it would be atypical to see such a kind of long explanation of roof systems on a book about sustainability. And I think the roof is often kind of not given the amount of emphasis that is due to it. If we think about like windows from energy, air quality for health, the roof is all about durability, right? And durability is like a fundamental purpose of architecture. And each of these chapters, I try to go back, like, why are we doing this thing? Like, why do we have buildings to begin with? We have buildings to provide shelter, right? We have buildings to keep out wild animals. We have buildings to keep us warm, to keep us protected. If the building is not keeping the rain out, it fails as a building. And we've had lots of examples of well-published buildings that were incapable of keeping the rain out. Buildings that were tens or hundreds of million dollars.
Yeah,
that
doesn't... Some architect names come to mind.
Some architect names might come to mind for the audience as well. And those are just complete failures because the fundamental purpose of a building is to keep the rain out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't get that simple thing right, you're not going to be able to really accomplish anything else.
Yeah, I'm with you. And in that context, multi-story buildings, those 7, 8, 10-story buildings we're talking about, the walls, certainly in the upper walls, they're not the roof, but they're instrumental again in the air control area and also instrumental in the air, in the water control area, keeping the building dry. But back to the roof, are there design principles that you use? And are you thinking about, I'm having trouble right now, like knowing that you design a range of building types, right?
Right.
So I guess, talk about that.
Build buildings, big buildings, small buildings, houses versus commercial buildings.
Yeah.
There's two basic types of roofs, right? There's a flat roof, a membrane roof, and there's a pitched roof, right? Yeah. And I think when possible, the best roof option is just a standing seam metal roof, right? Mm-hmm. It's sloped, it's durable, you can clip solar panels onto it, it's non-toxic, it's recyclable. Gravity is its friend. If you can do a standing seam metal roof, you should do a standing seam metal roof. But of course, that's not practical for every building type. Right? A very large high school is going to require a flat roof just because the pitch would be ridiculously tall.
Tall buildings.
Right. Or tall buildings are going to have...
Right,
because they look pretty goofy.
Imagine every building in New York just dumping all its water onto the sidewalk.
Right, onto the sidewalk, yeah. And then you look at a flat roof. And then there's different flat roof membranes that you can use. Some have different levels of toxicity. You want to be cognizant of flame retardants. You want to make sure it's going to last as long as possible because if a building roofs won't be replaced on schedule the way we want them to be. So the longer they last, the less chance there is it's going to be leaks that cause water damage, that cause mold, that cause all these other problems.
You're here. I love it. You make it sound so simple.
So
maintenance is so important, woven in there for membrane roofs, flat roofs. So something I'm feeling like a little excitement and smirk here to get you to answer on the podcast. Talk to me about green roofs. What do you think about green roofs? Roofs with plants growing on them.
Yeah, so I do talk about green roofs on in the book. So there's pluses and minuses, right? And a positive of a green roof is that you provide habitat. It has natural cooling. You add more greenery into the space. So and they're beautiful to look at. If you're looking down on a green roof, basically a green roof is going to be a flat roof built on a membrane, and there would be some sort of drainage. At the same time, it's a little risky because what we want roofs to do is shed water as quickly as possible. And when you have a green roof, you're inherently maintaining water on the roof. So I would say that there's pros and cons there. Right. So I'm not going to say that we should avoid green roofs, but I'm also not sure that it's the roof strategy that we should apply citywide.
Right. I'm thinking about wildfire-prone regions, right? You have to water your roof.
You have to water your
roof. Or you have kindling on your roof.
Right.
Right, yeah. Yeah. I tilt my hand there. I'm sure there are applications for green roofs where I could nod and smile, but generally I don't know. I recognize that they're green because you have green plants growing on them, but there's this other definition of green in our society that I don't know. I mean, partly because of the really high embodied carbon of those materials. It's usually multiple layers and dimple mats, and there might be more simple ways. I've heard recently there are simpler ways. Yeah, please.
I'll say one benefit of a green roof, like a clear benefit, is if you are, let's say you have a school in an urban context, and you have a tight site, and there's just not any other greenery. The green roof is the opportunity to provide students with a view to nature. And
so
sometimes
it's
the only one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's incredibly important.
Yeah.
But if you have a small building, and you can do standing seam, and you can see trees, there would be no reason to do a green roof.
Mm-hmm.
Large scale farming.
Trying to keep things a pace here, but is there
a lot of systems to cover.
Just last thing about roofs that's coming up for me is solar PV, energy generation.
So there are other values of roofs. So keeping the water out, shedding water quickly, super important. What other values of roofs are there?
Oh, overhangs, right? Shading.
Yeah, we can do shading, super important. Getting the water to drip further from the enclosure, especially on lower buildings.
Keep
on taller
the
buildings, it'll be harder. But you can have roof decks, right? Getting people outdoor space, providing energy generation. It's really important that if your roof slopes, it slopes in a direction that allows for energy generation, right? Or if you have a flat roof, you can just put solar panels up there regardless.
Well said. Good. I'm going to keep us moving.
All right. We'll keep moving along.
Okay.
No,
yes.
That's perfect.
And this is one of the ones, remember in the beginning of the podcast, I said you could quibble over the order. So the next one's structure, right? And so that was one of the ones I'm like, huh, structure is, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down in a list of 10. And yet it's where the concrete and steel, the high embodied carbon. But anyway, I'm not asking you to defend the order about structure. Talk to me of the choices among structural systems.
I would say one thought on the order is all of these systems are important. So
that's a good point.
Right? It's like even the fifth most important system on a building is going to be really important, right? You have a building without a roof, it doesn't work. You have a building without
windows, it doesn't work.
Building without structure, it doesn't work. So it's hard to really say that one of these is so much more important than the other.
That's true.
But I do think windows are just fundamental. So I think windows had to be up there, and windows are based on the massing, the form, the scale. Mm-hmm. So you need to place the window somewhere. But if you think of windows primarily around energy, right? Air around human health, roof around durability, the structure is where you want to focus on embodied carbon, right? And other building systems, interior finishes, insulation, whatever else, also have an impact on embodied carbon. But a lot of that decision is really going to come down to the structural system, right? There's really just three structural systems that you can, through structural materials, concrete, steel, and wood, I would say.
And blends.
And everyone is actually a blend between those, right? It's going to be hard to find a building that doesn't have either wood or concrete.
Because concrete always has metal in it, yeah, of course.
Right, and the foundation is going to be concrete even on a wood building.
Right.
But that's your opportunity, right? The structural system is your opportunity to address embodied carbon, which is incredibly important. And I make the case in the book, and some people might find this not true or controversial, but embodied carbon is where we need to be focusing over operational carbon. And the reason is because of the electrification and cleaning of the grid. So we get to the point in the future where embodied carbon might be all the carbon that we need to deal with.
The big upfront burp, that's all it is.
Right. And it all happens on year zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so important to keep that in mind. I love that you're associating elements of a building with broad principles of sustainable design. And I love that this is where you put embodied carbon. I am thinking about, I don't know if we want to go through each one, but let's talk about wood right now. Okay. Let's talk about CLT right now. Let's talk about mass timber, because generally there's a trend, and it's a positive trend, I believe. It's a relational signaling trend at the very least, where it is wood is better than concrete. If you can use wood to replace steel in certain applications, it's good. And there's a but, you know, but it's not as simple as wood is good.
Right.
Talk to me about that.
So I talk in the book about the difference between good wood and bad wood, right? So if you were to clear cut a forest and replace it with a parking lot and take all that wood and build mass timber buildings, like, obviously that's not a great, that's not a great approach. That's not a very sustainable solution. But if you were to responsibly manage and harvest wood from a healthy forest and use that wood to build buildings, and that the area where the wood was harvested is now growing new trees, that's a really effective approach.
Yeah.
Right? Because what you're doing is twofold. You're sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere into wood and locking it into buildings. But more importantly, you're avoiding the emissions associated with concrete and steel, the alternative option.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, I'm trying to keep things on pace, and also I think it's so important to recognize that, you know, what we say is, okay, well, we need a rating system for wood to make sure we select good wood. And yet, even in that context, it's not that simple, because as soon as you say, hey, wood producers, we're going to give SFC or, you know, downgrade a little to SFI. What about all the small mom and pop that can't even afford to participate in that and that might have good practices? Yeah, please, yes.
So what I try to do in the book is I think that FSC is great. And if you can get FSC wood, it's probably be a cost premium, but you could be pretty confident that you're getting, quote unquote, good wood, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not the only source of good wood, right? There are the small farms that you mentioned. There's tribal wood producers. There's wood that's thinned to make the forest safer for wildfire prevention. There's beetle kill. There's lots of good wood out there that's not necessarily FSC.
Yeah.
So in the book, I lay out some of the criteria around FSC wood. What does it mean to harvest wood sustainably? That way you can look at sourcing from specific metrics to make informed decisions. So for instance, what is the maximum clear cut area? The smaller the better, right? So we can maintain some continuity in the forest. How much has to be reserved in that area, right? Do you require one tree per acre, or do you require 10% trees per acre? What is the buffer area around streams? Is it 10 feet, 20 feet? Is it a quarter mile? Just understanding the practices that an individual mill or forest manager uses will allow you to make informed decisions. Now, in order to do that, you need to know where your wood is coming from. And I think that's the first step for architects, is to ask questions, to be curious. If we are building a mass timber building, or really just have any sort of wood elements in a building, what forest is that coming from? What mill is that coming from? And what are the forestry practices that result in this building material?
Love it. Yeah. Got me nodding big time. So micro comment and a macro comment. I'll start with micro. Reclaimed wood is also a great place to get wood.
Reclaimed wood is great.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I've heard since there's some really good facilities out there. Shameless plug. We talked to Jacob Rakusin and Bruce King about Rating Industries on a previous podcast. So the macro comment is that, you know, the role of architecture in society is powerful, as we've said in your previous podcasts. And everything in the world right now is starting to fall under the role of the architect, you know, like climate, health.
Right, we need to understand forest equity, management practices. Just,
exactly.
Right?
And so
architects didn't historically need to do that.
Exactly. And my point is that there's this sort of turning away from that. You can just feel architects like throwing their hands up in despair, like, ay, 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 I didn't sign up for all this. But then the reality is that it is still finite, bounded bodies of knowledge that you can find paths through that are effective. And that's what your book is. Like, it's like a trail guide through these things. And why not embrace it?
You know? Yeah, I mean, if we can design beyond the site, that's what everyone wants to do anyway.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I think, yeah.
The pen controls the backhoe.
Take the opportunity, embrace the challenge, and use every project to have a real meaningful impact in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, just, you know, what is, I don't know the expression, but, you know, how do you eat an elephant or something one bite at a time, right? It's like, I mean, I just might have made that up, but what I'm saying
it's
is...
It's a very common expression.
There's this knee-jerk reaction to say, it's too much, I give up.
Right.
And it's like, well, why not say, it's a lot, I should start now.
Right.
Later is too late.
I should start now, I should start small. I should make a real impact. And I should probably start with what's hardest.
Yeah. And most carbon impactful. You know, cause, and another thing, carbon, we talked about CO2 being a proxy for occupancy. We didn't say that, but it's on other episodes. Carbon is a proxy for environmental degradation, and we are part of the environment, right? It's not like some other thing. Okay, next section is electricity, essential to the built environment, but we often waste it. Any thoughts on that?
So this is an interesting chapter for me because I spent a lot of time thinking about the impact and role of architects in designing energy efficient buildings in the context of a greening grid. So we know, I think it's fairly clear that a net zero building is not the ultimate goal, right? And that's what is the value of a net zero building in a carbon-free grid? It doesn't make a huge amount of sense. Or maybe it's just misplaced effort. But what we do want to do is make sure our buildings are energy efficient. We want to have the smallest impact. There's always going to be a cost of electricity, even if the cost is smaller than burning coal. So there's always going to be value in energy conservation.
Yeah, you've been talking around, you used the term conservation there and you used the term efficiency earlier. Could you describe those briefly? And before you do, readers, listeners, I'd just like you to know, Corey has no notes here. He's just, this is just all coming out of his head, right? Well, he's writing down the questions I asked. Okay, yeah, efficiency and conservation contrast.
I think this is a really important concept that I lay out in the book. I'll give an example that's tangential to buildings. So let's say you need to go to the store and you're going to take your pickup truck, right? And you're going to burn a certain amount of fossil fuels. And an alternative, a more efficient option, is to take your Prius, right? Instead of the pickup truck with a miles per gallon of 20, you now have your Prius with a mile gallons per 50, whatever. It's more than twice as efficient. That's great. But what if the thing you were going to buy at the store, you didn't need? It's like not necessary at all. It was a potato masher, but you already have a fork. So you're fine. Conservation would be just not buying that thing, right? Mm-hmm. And the difference between efficiency and conservation is efficiency always costs more because you have to employ technology. So to go from the pickup truck to the Prius, you have to add an electric motor, a battery pack, the whole hybrid kind of car drivetrain. Conservation always costs less because you're just going without. And in buildings, we're always so focused on efficiency. It's like, can we get a more efficient HVAC system, right? But we know it's going to cost more. Can we take the SEER from 13 to 16 or 18 or whatever else?
Don't get me started.
But conservation just says, do we need that bedroom, right? No, we don't need the bedroom. We don't have to pay for a whole bedroom, which means that we get the same energy performance without a more efficient mechanical system. We can stick to the SEER 16 and it's fine. So the message that I try to make in the book is focus on conservation first and then efficiency, right? Figure out what you don't need, drop it. And then what you do need, design in a way as efficient as possible, as opposed to what we typically do is saying like, we have this unnecessary 10,000 square foot addition with a really high performance mechanical system, right? It's like, why?
Yeah.
So drop things first, and then what is absolutely necessary, make as efficient as possible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Sufficiency comes to mind as another
sufficiency, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Conservation efficiency.
And yeah, you know, we need to be very clear about what the goals are, what the purpose of a design exercise is.
Yeah.
And if more is not benefiting us, we should just drop it.
Yeah. You know, and it makes me want to you know, thinking broadly in systems, right, we're immersed in capitalist democracy, consumer society, and part of that is manufacturer messaging. Like, you know, we're not just immersed in air of our own making, we're immersed in messaging of our own making, and the messaging often has to do with instilling a sense of lack, a sense of you quickly need this new technology to, I don't know, be safe or be relationally accepted or... Well, that's a little digression there.
But no, it's an important point because buildings inform lifestyle, and often when we're thinking about conservation, it has to do with lifestyle. And let's say we have a house and we have less storage, right? Having a house with less storage means you're going to buy less stuff.
Yeah.
And you might initially be like, no, I really want the storage. But without the storage, you might be happier. And being happy is a fundamental value of good architecture.
You could say everything we do is about... is intended to have us live a happier life, right? But who knows if that's really working.
I'll share one more thought about electricity before we move on.
Yeah.
And it has to do with kind of the value of the use of electricity, where not all electricity is used equally. And the example that I give in the book is if you're powering a second home with electricity, it's a very different outcome than powering a school in a underserved neighborhood with electricity, right? And so there's value propositions to that. It's like we should be investing. It's okay for the school to use electricity, but is it okay for the person to be running their house when they're not there in their vacation home? It's like that person should probably take responsibility for that energy and offset it with solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
While society should be okay with a little bit of pollution that results from educating kids.
Yeah, yeah, it's so important. Yeah, it's interesting how the macro and the micro weave together. Another place they do that in electricity, and I know we're moving on, is the energy transition. You know, as you say, we're going from fossil to electric, and now we can start to have energy storage, which ties into thermal storage, which ties into the enclosure and the mechanicals. It all just starts to blend together. But there's one last topic on electricity that I remember from your book, and I actually am taking some notes here, the modern epidemic of blinking lights.
Oh, yeah. So I end this chapter with a little aside on darkness. Personally, I'm a huge fan of darkness. My expectation is that at night it should be dark. And fundamentally, I think buildings should be able to turn off. And there's a phrase for it. You can say design for off. Like, is there a switch that I could hit and everything goes off? It turns out that it's really hard to turn buildings off. Right, there's systems that remain on all the time. There's blinking lights. There's receptors so that you can turn things on in a moment's notice. And I would say, what are we losing from all of this? Right, we're losing darkness. We're losing. We're obviously using unnecessary energy. A huge amount of energy is used in buildings that are unoccupied at night. Really rethink our relationship with darkness or with the night.
Mm-hmm.
Even in my own neighborhood, a new neighbor moved in next door and suddenly installed all this exterior lighting.
Mm.
And from their perspective, maybe they think they're going to be safer. Maybe they think they're doing the neighborhood a benefit. But it's awful. And what we should be doing instead is at night, light should go out. We should be able to turn things off and things should just go off.
I'm totally with you. You got me nodding. Yeah. Design for off also ties into EMF. Which is a whole nother, you know, can of worms.
The next podcast.
Yeah, and yeah, we've actually talked about that. But so you were just reminding me. So in my neighborhood, the city chose new streetlights, and they chose these LEDs that are like, it's like I'm at the eye doctor having a retinal scan. Just, you know, I'm out walking my dog. I'm like,
all right, I'll tell a quick story about when my wife and I were living in Texas. Same thing happened right in front of our street. The city came by and put in new LED lights, and they were like 5,000 degrees Kelvin.
Yeah.
Some ridiculous, it was like daylight.
Blue,
gleaming daylight inside of our house. And I was like, we're moving. We just can't live here. Well, what we ended up doing, we went to Home Depot. We
bought
a 20-foot painting pole, and we painted the lenses black.
Oh, my God.
The light in front of our house, and then the two lights on either side. And it was funny. Elena was like in the street and I was off to the side with the painting pole. She's like, there's no cars coming. Come quickly. And I lift up the painting pole and paint the light.
Did some light still come through?
and some light came through. But what it looked like was a normal light at that point. The color temperature was way down. The brightness was way down. It was suddenly super comfortable. It was the nicest part of our whole street.
Yeah. Okay, and you're getting into, like, you know, car headlights are doing the same thing these days. And now I'm hearing that they're going to have adaptive headlights that know if they're in a lens, in if they're shining on the windshield of an oncoming driver, and they're going to turn. It's like, you know,
it's
complexity
begetting
complexity.
A little complicated. Why don't we just get the right light in the first place?
Okay, so now we're moving on to interior finishes, right? The things that we're in direct contact with, that we're surrounded with. This is a big one.
So, huge topic. We can obviously have a whole podcast on this.
Or many,
And it's a real challenge for a lot of practitioners and a lot of firms out there. It's like nobody wants to specify toxic materials, but what we do it all the time because we just don't know and don't have the time to do that in-depth research. So what I try to do in this chapter is provide some heuristics to know if we should take a second look at a material. So I call them red flags. So what are some things that might raise a red flag? It's like plastics that bend should raise a red flag because they're full of phthalates. Any sort of new super property, like stain resistance, hydrophobic, like those should raise red flags. Mm-hmm. Like what material, what chemical is in there, what coating
flame
is in there?
Yeah.
Flame retardants. Anything related to flame retardants should raise red flags.
Because the material would burn, but no, we put this flame retardant on it, like spray foam.
Even look at like baby pajamas that you have to know not to buy the baby pajamas that are treated with flame retardants.
Even after Arlene Bloom did all her work, they just keep switching around. So, I guess a couple of the dimensions of the interior finishes. I mean, there's as you say, this could be multiple chapters. But one that I'm going to start with is biogenic materials is the word.
So that's another heuristic, right? If it's natural, if it's unaltered, it's local, it's probably going to be safe. You probably don't have to do more research.
Right.
The opposite of that, if it's heavily processed, if it's from another part of the world.
I was about to say a distance.
Yeah. If it's very complicated.
Heavy.
If it's heavy, you really got to.
Not always heavy, but.
Well, heavy from an embodied carbon standpoint, right?
Right.
But from interior finishes, like you really have to dig in if some of those other characteristics come up.
Yeah. Okay, I think we can wrap this one up also by saying, like, architects recognize that they're curating materials to create experiences for the clients in the indoor environment. And as we talked about in air, right, you know, air is a material. Let's assume that's good. Well, the air is in an intimate contact with the materials and vice versa, right? So there's air chemistry that's impacting surface chemistry, there's surface chemistry impacting air chemistry.
Yeah, so something like humidity. Like we go back to air quality. Humidity is going to increase the VOCs that get released.
Right.
So all this stuff is interconnected.
And the UV coming through the windows, hitting the surfaces that are unstable. Yeah, so it all is interconnected, and it all has, you know, health impacts, durability impacts, environmental impacts, social impacts. Boy, we left a lot on the table. Let's move on. Let's talk about...
Read the chapter.
Read the chapter, yeah. And then keep reading and studying, yes. It starts somewhere. And this book's such a fantastic place to start. It depixelates the image in a lot of ways and also creates like whole categories of places to dig in more.
And big picture, this book should be the only resource that a firm needs to really transition towards high-performance design, right? There's lots of resources out there. I wrote this book to be the one-stop shop. Where you understand the best practices in all these important building systems, but also, like part one and part two, the premises, the communication strategies, and the cultural norms that allow this all to take place. So,
dude,
big picture, but
that was huge.
We could jump back into the building systems.
Yeah, and that would be like almost like a mic drop moment at the end. That's huge. So, listeners, if you're on a podcast player, you can go back few seconds and hear that one again. Okay, so the last three, benefits of trees, access, and user behavior. Let's start with the benefits of trees, which, by the way, we're talking about design, we're talking about building systems. So a little bit of an eyebrow up here for you.
I would say the reason that I included this chapter is because I want us to consider trees as a building system. And I don't think that we give trees the benefit that's due to them when we're designing. So if we think about what trees can do, let's just say the trees that are adjacent to buildings, right? They provide shade, they provide great views. They absorb stormwater. They cool the site.
Wow, yeah.
They do,
again, listeners, no notes. Top of his head.
They do all these things that otherwise we would have to employ building systems to use.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So if we didn't have trees to shade, we have, I don't know, interior shades which might be made of vinyl, or we have exterior shades that might be aluminum and high embodied carbon. If we didn't have trees for stormwater retention, then the water's going to flow off the site, and the municipalities have to deal with it, which is a very carbon-intensive process, right? If we didn't have trees to look at, maybe we put them on the roof, which goes back to our conversation earlier. Maybe that's not the best roof strategy. But often what we see is that we disregard trees on site, and we might just cut them down so that the building fits in better, right? Or we might not replace trees to the quantity that is either was there historically or is necessary. Or we might take land and convert it to a parking lot, right? Which is terrible for the environment, right? It increases runoff, has solar heat gain. It's a very human, infriendly environment. It's hard to overstate the value that trees will provide us, especially in urban settings. But I don't think we consider that value when we're making design decisions.
Yeah, well said, yeah. Habitat for critters,
right?
You know, good critters. And then another one is carbon sequestration.
Carbon sequestration on top of all of that.
And soil, yeah. So, okay, benefits of trees. You convinced me. It's a building system, and it really is. It's a building embedded in its environment, and the trees are impacting it.
And you think of like urban heat island effect, right? In wealthier neighborhoods, you have more trees, which means the neighborhood's cooler, which now means your HVAC system actually runs less, right? Mm-hmm. Which means you're conserving energy. So there's this added harm. Not just is the poor neighborhood with less trees less comfortable, but they're actually using more energy to reach the same level of comfort.
Yeah.
So if we everything that trees can do that we don't let trees do will be done more poorly by a more expensive and carbon intensive system.
Dude, another mic drop. Beautiful. That's actually a really, really powerful way to say it. Access. Talk to me about access. Interestingly, again, in the context of design and a building system, but yeah.
So
I can see it in design.
I would say equity in architecture is an incredibly important topic, and I think that equity is sprinkled throughout the book, throughout all these chapters, right? There's strong connections to equity in structure, thinking about bicarbon and air quality, thinking about interior environment, in material selection. Thinking about both the chemicals inside of buildings, but also the supply chains and the manufacturing processes.
Yeah.
But getting very kind of dialed into equity within a building among building occupants is what this chapter is about. And I think that as much discussion of equity in the built environment as there is, I think a lot of the conversation has not been incredibly impactful.
Whoa.
What I talk about in terms of equity is access. How can we make spaces that are amenable to a wide variety of people with a wide variety of preferences and abilities? And fundamentally, this is around providing choice. So when we're designing a building, we want to provide different thermal environments, different acoustical environments, different seating arrangements, different pieces of furniture, because people all work differently, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about an office, for instance, we have sit-stand desks, that's great, right? But some people might work better in a very quiet setting, so we can have acoustical refuge areas. Some people might work better in loungy chairs, right? Mm-hmm. So we can provide that.
And thermal, too.
Some people might...
Hot environments, cold.
Right. Some people might need a hotter environment. Some people might want to work outside. Mm-hmm. Some people might want to work entirely by themselves. Some people, among other people. So providing a wide variety of spaces so that people can use your agency, can choose what's best for them, I think is fundamental to equity within the built environment. And this extends to things like control of thermostats. So you often go into buildings and you might see something like a plastic box with a lock around the thermostat. It's like, what signal are we sending?
We don't care about you.
Right. Like, your preferences are not relevant, or your comfort is not relevant to us. Or you might think about a building without operable windows.
Cage.
What signal are we sending? It's like, is like, oh, we don't trust you to open and then close a window.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Why would somebody feel welcome in a space when we don't even trust them to open a window, right? And this also, I spent a good amount of time talking about how people access buildings initially. So some of it has to do with transportation. Why do we design buildings where the front door is very car-centric, while people who provide who arrive at a building on a bicycle, public transportation, whatever else?
Loading dock.
There's a loading dock for you, right? I worked on a project at a former firm. It was a school where it was organized in a way so the students who were being dropped off by their parents walk in the front door, but the students who were coming on the public bus go in through the back door. It's like, what signals are we sending when we do something like that?
Oh, my goodness.
So access to the building is incredibly important. We need to recognize that people have preferences, and we should provide for a wide, wide, wide variety of preferences.
I'm nodding. I can't top that. I agree. That's beautiful. It's deep. It's you have this way of making subtle, deep things just like seem so like... I would have thought of that.
I did spend a lot of time. I mean, I wrote the book, so I spent a lot of time thinking about it in preparation. I'm not just coming up with this stuff on the top of my head.
Yeah. I mean, frankly, it is kind of amazing to me who has some of the notes here from reading the book. And I'm like, oh, he's not going to remember access. I mean, I'm sorry, of course access, but the trusting in users. But no, you did.
Trusting users. Yeah. I mean,
just impressive.
You gotta trust users.
All right. Speaking of users, the last chapter.
So last
user behavior, right? So the building itself is part of its story, and then
it's almost like towards the end, I'm kind of straying from the building system approach a little bit, but I think that we can think about trees as a building system. We can think about access, what we're providing for occupants as a building system, and we can think about the occupants themselves as a building system. And I think if we don't, it's at our peril, right? Because building occupants have the ability to operate the building and occupy the building in a way that it helps the building achieve their goals, the building's goals or the architect's goals, or not, or use it in some contrary way, right? Mm-hmm. So you can have your best intentions in the world about energy conservation, but if the set points are then set to, like, I don't know, 65 degrees in the summer nonstop, then it doesn't matter what you did anywhere else, right? The building's going to be very energy intensive.
Right.
And why would the occupants set the thermostat to be 65 degrees? Maybe they're not educated. Maybe they're experiencing a poor radiant environment. Maybe they're wearing too many clothes, and that should have been considered in the design. I give the example of a church where the priest who wears all these heavy vestments is controlling the thermostat and making everybody else
freeze.
Thermally uncomfortable. Right. So
yeah.
Can the architect think about that ahead of time and accommodate, because it goes back to access a little bit, accommodate individual preferences.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time talking about feedback loops. So if building users know how much energy the building is using, they're probably going to use less energy.
Especially if they can compare it to their neighbor's building.
Right.
Their neighbor's house, yeah. You know,
you're kicking that competitive instinct and you get a lot of benefit out of that.
Yeah. In fact, I was just reading a book that Bill Brandt talked about when you assemble materials into a building, the building has this implicit information content. And, you know, like the enclosure is mediating thermal flows. And actually, for the thermostat to have relevance, you need the building, the information flow of the building, for the thermostat to work. And this is a way of opening up automation, home automation, building automation, control systems. That's another form of feedback loops. But we're generally locked out of those. Yeah.
Yeah, I talk about feedback loops, I guess, from the, like, building automation perspective in the electricity chapter. We talk about, like, systems should be able to turn things off, but only building users should be able to turn things on, which is incredibly important.
Like a sweep. All these things
like
are
a sweep,
on.
Right,
you
got
to prove to me you still want them.
Prove to me you're still here. And do it every hour.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the examples around building users are, like, if you have a dashboard that shows your energy use, right, you'll use less energy, right? If you have a menu that displays calories, maybe you'll choose a meal with less calories. Or, Christoph, as you mentioned, like competition. I reference New York City's benchmarking law, where suddenly when everyone was required to reveal publicly the utility bills and the energy intensity of their buildings, those at the top, and by the top I mean the bottom, the very high energy users, suddenly realized for the first time that they were very high energy users. They would have had no idea otherwise. Hmm. And they invested in improvements. And there was a significant reduction in electricity and carbon emissions for the whole city of New York just through this benchmarking law,
right?
Which had no technological intervention. It was purely information flow.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And it reminds me of the efficiency versus conservation in the sense that just a small cut, you know, in conservation is actually a large amount of energy, and you know, we represent a lot of efficiency. You also talk about here in the user behavior section, choice architecture. Talk to me about that.
Choice, so encouraging, so the idea around choice architecture is how do you design in a way to encourage people to use a building as you want them to use it, right? So a classic example here is you make the staircase more accessible than the elevator. And that will result in more people using the stair and the elevator, right? While if you have the elevator in the lobby and the stair is a fire escape, you're going to have more people using the elevator. Now, the benefit of more people using the stairs is, I mean, there's a health benefit, obviously, from climbing stairs. There's a energy benefit, use less energy. You need to make sure that the elevator is fully accessible so that people who are incapable of using stairs don't feel like they need to go to the back room. But the majority of people who are capable of using stairs should be encouraged to use stairs because it really benefits everyone. And you can think about that in a lot of different aspects of building design. Using design elements to tip the occupant's decision-making process towards a better outcome.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Okay, last one, and then we'll do the wrap-up. You also have strategies for building community in this user behavior section.
Yeah. Trying to remember. Yeah, there's a lot of the chapters kind of blend into a variety of writer topics. There was a lot that I wanted to say, and I was trying to fit it into kind of 10 buckets.
I'm not saying it's in the wrong bucket or whatever. But
And this kind of goes back to this fundamental purpose of architecture. We talked about the fundamental purpose of architecture is keeping the rain out, right? You have a roof on a building, keeps the rain out, and then at that point, the building has the potential of being successful, right? It's not necessarily successful for keeping the rain out, but it's necessarily unsuccessful if it doesn't. But providing space for community is just as important as keeping the rain out. That's a fundamental purpose of buildings that have gone back since we started building buildings as a species, We're social beings, right? We like to be dry, but we also like to be together.
Yeah.
And it's really a fundamental. What I have found, and I think that there has also been some research that has backed up this idea, is that people with means use money to build, to basically isolate themselves, right? And that makes them less happy.
Yeah.
Right? So let's say that you go to the community pool and you're seeing your neighbors, you're around other people.
Watch their kids grow up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or you build your own, you have the money, so you're going to build your own pool in the backyard. And now the benefit is you can go swimming whenever you want, and you're private, and you're by yourself. But you lost something by not going to the community pool. Or you lost something by having a lawn that you can play in, so you don't have to go to the park anymore.
Or a giant freezer chest, so you never need to go to the grocery store.
Right. Like, we need to be out and about. We need to check our bad incentives or bad behavior at using money to isolate ourselves, to buy self-sufficiency at the detriment of community. So when we think about choice architecture, we think about designing for user behavior, how do we design spaces that encourage social interaction? I think that's just as important as any other of the outcomes that we've discussed, just as important as health, just as important as carbon reduction, just as important as ecology or equity. It's just using design to get people together.
Yeah.
So I provide a whole bunch of opportunities, design strategies, opportunities thinking about buildings through that lens.
Yeah. Well said.
A large scale farming.
Okay, so we've arrived at the end, thinking about what we just talked about. I mean, one of the big themes for me, and with due respect, it's not just about your book, but your book has really brought it to my mind. There is so much to think about to do good design, right? To do design appropriately. And I really do believe that I've watched it proliferate over the last, you know, I've been in the industry around 20 years, proliferating the number of topics, the complexity, and people are, they're no longer embracing learning, they're hiding from learning. And I'm really glad that we brought up on this interview, like, just start somewhere. And if you know what, if you feel saturated and you can't take on anymore, find a friend, split it up. Find a group of friends and split it up. So I'm glad we brought that up. But one thing that you've used the term high performance design several times. I believe you've had a role as a sustainability director. Could you contrast?
I'll talk about the phrase, the terminology.
High performance design versus sustainable design, yeah.
So in the preface of my book, I talk about the fact that I'm not going to use the word sustainable in the book. And I think short of that explanation in the preface, I don't use the word sustainable once, or sustainable design, or sustainability. And it's all very intentional. And what I found is that sustainability is just really a bad word to use to describe what we're trying to get across. We're trying to get across as value, right? Added value in community, added value in human health, enjoyment, protection for the planet. Sustainability, the reason you use the word sustainability is to signal a value set to like-minded people, right? So the reason that my title is sustainability director is because people recognize what that means, and people who are interested in a certain value set come talk to me about sustainability on projects. But
again, community.
But from the perspective of what we're trying to do to the architecture profession, we're just trying to make better buildings, right? And it just so happens that a quote-unquote sustainable building is a better building, a building that provides greater health, greater enjoyment, bigger community. Those are just good things, just inherently good things. So I use the word high performance or high performance design to get across this idea of just better, right? You have this crappy old regular building, or you have a high performance version. And the high performance version thought through things like health, and thought through things like carbon, and thought through things like resilience. And it's a fundamentally better product.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, and so we've mentioned the word better in a few contexts, and I think I want to make a final thought on it here. Like, so we've talked about build smaller, better buildings, but there's also this, better design or doing things better in design. And I have the sense that there are like energy efficiency versus energy conservation, doing things better implies following the same trajectory with some trimming around the edges. Whereas doing better things is really kind of where you're coming from here on this book.
Yeah. Think differently about what we're trying to accomplish. I mentioned a few times, each chapter I kind of go back to, what are buildings fundamentally for? What's their purpose? Mm-hmm. And let's make sure that we get that purpose right. We design buildings that result in the desired purpose, right? The point of a roof is not to have a roof, it's to keep the rain out, right? The point of electricity is to allow us to see at night, allow us to stay warm. It's not to have electricity. And we want to make sure that we're using these systems towards their intended purpose, so we get the benefits without the byproducts.
Excellent. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, you could have that be your final word. Do you have any?
There we go. Well, thank you so much for having me. The book is People, Planet, Design, Practical Guide to Realizing Architecture Potential, available at Island Press's website. Island Press is the publisher, or Amazon, or local bookstores. And what I hear a lot these days is that people don't read as much as they used to. I encourage that if you're interested in this topic and you want to transform your practice or your firm, I promise this is the one book to read. But if you don't want to read it, Christoph and I have recorded these three podcasts, cover the majority of the topic, and it'll get you, I don't know.
Yeah, and they can hire the way there. Department of Sustainability to talk to you.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Corey. Thank you for the plug for the podcast. And just thank you for all you do for the industry and your friendship over the years. And it means a lot.
All right. Thank you, Christoph.
You're welcome. And thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you next time.